and gentlemen, please welcome our panelists. Karan Grover, founder, Karan Grover and Associates. Maria Atkinson, global head of sustainability, Lendlease. Carlton Brown, principal and chief operating officer, Full Spectrum of New York. Stephen Lane, global director, capital projects, City Realty Services, Citi. And our moderator, William McDonough, principal, William McDonough and Partners.
Well, welcome, everybody. This should be a fun panel. We've had a lot of fun getting ready, and I think you'll find this to be quite exciting because I know that the topic is very exciting to all of us. If we look at the history of green building and the concept of accelerating green building, we realize that the history of this goes all the way back through to the beginning of human habitation. And we realize that our buildings today account for over 40% of climate change effects. And if you look in the New York Times today, as was just pointed out, there's a full page ad that says, "Want to stop global warming? Stop coal." This comes from Architecture 2030. The architects are getting together to help tackle this problem, because if you look at the issue of coal and you realize from a design perspective, and as we know, design is the first signal of human intention. If we ask ourselves, what are our intentions around the future of climate change, of material safety and health and so on, it brings us to our buildings and the things of human artifice, the things we make. And so we realize at this point in history we have to get solar energy in all of its forms, renewable energy, cheaper than coal. That is our mission, and needs to be directed. Part of that direction will be to use our buildings to create what Amory Lovins famously called megawatts, and to go quickly towards efficiencies of a very high order, leading us to an effectiveness which allows us to renewably power our buildings. Now, if we go back and look at design before coal, I think it's really really telling to look at Ralph Waldo Emerson, who in 1831, after his wife died, went to Europe on a sailboat. Well, a few weeks later, he returned in a steamship. So if we see this as the cusp of the first industrial revolution, he goes over on a solar-powered, recyclable craft operated by craftspeople practicing ancient arts in the open air, returns in a steel rust bucket, putting smoke into the sky, oil into the water, operated by people working in the darkness, shoveling fossil fuels into the mouths of boilers. This is design. We are sitting in that steamship right now as I speak. We're sitting in here producing climate change and global warming and nuclear isotopes so that we can sit here and talk about climate change, global warming, and nuclear isotopes. We are in the boiler room right now. So what can happen? Well, design, as we know and as we can see from people like Thomas Jefferson, one of the great designers for long-term prosperity. It's interesting to note that the people in this room are Thomas Jefferson's seventh generation. All we need to do is look at his tombstone, his last design, and notice that on it he only recorded the things he designed, the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, effectively, and the University of Virginia. And realize that he saw design as legacy. It's what we leave behind. So today you'll hear from four panelists involved in building and design who are leading the way to a more aggressive uptake of green building and strategies. And to give you a sense of what's possible, just looking back in my own career, it's hard to believe, but in 1976, I built the first solar heated house in Ireland, which should give you a sense of my ambition. There is no sun in Ireland. In 1984, we did the first green office in the United States for Fred Krupp and the Environmental Defense Fund. And we went to manufacturers and asked what were in their products, and they told us they're proprietary, they're legal, please go away. We now have databases done to the parts per million, parts per billion, on thousands and thousands of products. And I can tell you than when we first looked at a textile for cancer, birth defects, endocrine disruption, mutagenic effects. We looked at 8,000 chemicals in the textile industry, and using those intellectual filters had to eliminate 7,962. We did a building for Oberlin College that makes more energy than it needs to operate. Imagine a building that makes 30% more energy per year than it needs to function. It's a net energy exporter, and it purifies its own water, a building like a tree. How sophisticated are we as designers? If we think about humility and design, it's unfortunate that the word humble and the word architect have not appeared together since the fountainhead. But I think if anybody here has trouble with the concept of design humility, just reflect on the fact that it took us 5,000 years to put wheels on our luggage. We're not that smart. And we have a big job ahead of us here. Well, how do we get to do these things and things like the largest green roofs in the world and buildings that are starting to act like living things like trees? Imagine a design that makes oxygen, sequesters carbon, fixes nitrogen, distills water, provides habitat for hundreds of species, accrues solar energy as fuel, makes complex sugars in food, creates microclimates, and self-replicates. How many of our buildings made oxygen lately? So the goal is the human artifice would connect itself once again with the natural world. It would become a propitious and productive, meaningful part of it. And the four people we'll hear from today are directly connected with this movement in ways that are very profound and powerful. And I'd like to start by asking Karen Grover if he would describe this astonishing work that he's been able to achieve in India. Karen.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, CGI. Thank you, David, and your team, and thank you, Rob, for having me here. Green is an aesthetic. It is a strategy to make the most of what is available. It is infusion. As infusion draws the best from assorted sources of expertise to create elements of quality, it's interconnected. It is cooperation, and it is collaboration. I got into this movement by accident. When I was 22 years old, I was taken to a buried forest, at a forest where there was this buried city of 2,000 years. And my mentor said to me, "Can I gift this city to you?" This city was about three times the size of Pompeii. And I said, "Look, it's not yours to gift and it's not mine to take." But in the arrogance of youth, I said I would. And it is this extraordinary city which has taught me so many things. There is a superior intelligence that is almost understated in scale of these 115 buildings above the ground and 2,000 buildings below the ground. In fact, one of these days I'm going to try and plot the lead matrix on these buildings to see that they all actually could be platinum. There are no new stories to be told. They become new in the telling. But I think what is very important for me and what I would like to share with you is the fact that because these buildings were recognized and necessary, elements were necessary for survival, they became sacred. So they are water tanks, cisterns, stepwells, and it's quite extraordinary. I found a tablet which said, written 1,000 years ago, that if you can save the imprint of a hoof of a camel in the sand, that is about so much water, you will go to heaven nine times. So this has been my inspiration for the buildings that I do. I come from a country which has oral tradition. There are many people in this room who come from countries which have oral traditions. A person may not know how to read or write, but he knows how to work with nature. And I think it is there is wisdom, and we need to bring this mainstream. There are individuals across cultures who know how to work with nature, and in a way that we city folks will not even understand. I think we need to bring them with us. I also want to say that I worked on a tribal institute with the tribals. In India, concrete is the main building material. We built this entire building with bricks and without concrete, and I learned a lot from them. I'd also just like to touch on this issue of our children. Everyone's been talking about our children and our grandchildren, but in these tribal areas of India, they don't do anything which is not good for the seventh generation. Not their children, not their grandchildren, but five generations after that. And if it seems to be good, then they go ahead and do it. So we've been looking at kids, and we've started this movement with children, trying to make them understand, and we use water as an element, because water is very easy to understand, the lack of water, the fact that they have to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to collect water. And we've reached out to 200,000 children. These are our barefoot ambassadors for green. So with this, Bob, I give this back to you.
Carlton, perhaps we could, I think it flows well to hear about the work that you've been doing.
Okay, thank you, Bill. Our company, Full Spectrum, has really had a sort of narrow focus, but if you think about it, when it's applied globally, it's really a broad focus. We focused on how do you create sustainable urban communities in underserved markets. And what we find is the barriers to doing this are not technological at all. They tend to be more human constructs that have more to do with ethnicity, what we believe about race and gender, than it has to do with technology. So in our company, what we tried to do is look at strategies that are social neutral in creating equitable communities and apply those technological solutions to emerging markets in Harlem and Louisiana and Mississippi and come up with strategies where we can reduce energy by 30 to 50%, use renewable resources for energy from 25 to 30%. We've been able to do this effectively and not increase the cost of building. What we've had to do is rethink how we build. One of the things about the notion of building is, in some ways, we've lost the better things from the past and taken on the worse things. So when we think about losing the better things, we've lost thinking about things like building orientation and passive design. On the other hand, we've tried to replace good design thinking with better mechanical systems. Our solution is to go back to good design thinking, reducing the energy loads, and then using better systems. So we take advantage of natural systems, we reduce our costs, and probably the third thing that we do, which I think brings us to the 21st century, we look at building as a process that needs to be as modern as any other 21st century building process. So if you were going to build an airplane, you probably wouldn't want to build it the same way they built it in 1900. Or the same thing about a car. Well, we think that in our process, we've tried to revolutionize the way that we put building together as a process. As opposed to being hierarchical, it's more of a matrix. It's more like a quilt where everyone understands the end result, and we start with something that a lot of developers don't like to think of, but we start with community buy-in, developing a consensus about what the sustainability means to a particular community. What I find is it means something very different in Harlem from what it means in Jackson, Mississippi. So if you start with those sort of roots, right, which sometimes takes you back to that vernacular architecture, right, then you modernize it and find ways to make it more efficient. And that's the way you can break this sort of class barrier that so often we think we have when we talk about green buildings.
Thank you. Thank you, Carl. Stephen Lane is the Global Director for Capital Projects at Citi. Stephen, could you tell us about Citi's experience?
Sure. I thank you for the opportunity, first of all, on behalf of CGI. Citi is a very large organization that operates 15,000 buildings in over 100 countries, and so we have the opportunity to use our reach and our muscle and our ethic that we are environmental stewards to make change. And so we've also made a commitment to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by 10% by the year 2011, which is a daunting challenge for us. And decided that we needed to make a change in how we behaved at every stage of the real estate cycle, from the time we thought we needed space to the time we dispose of it. And we've embarked on a program to do this globally. And so from the time we need space, we either lease it, we build it, or we acquire it through acquisitions. When we build it, we've committed to LEED standards to make sure that we're building efficient, so we pay attention to things like water and all the other things that the LEED program stands for, and we'll get into standards as later in this conversation. If we lease it, we're starting to now go out to the real estate community and tell them that we want to live in high-performance buildings. Why? Because it impacts our occupancy cost. It also, there's building evidence that it impacts retention, for example. We believe that, for every dollar of salary you pay someone, you'll spend a dollar to replace that person. And if we can make a positive impact through building green buildings, we feel that there's an economic value to that as well as a staff productivity value. One company that we worked with has measured a drop in absenteeism of 15% when they've moved from one facility to the other. And we're about to move into a certified building that we're going to start to measure the same thing. So we think there's a real reason. When it comes to mergers and acquisitions, we pay close attention to the energy and carbon profile for the things that we are going to acquire. Bake that into the equation, not only for its economic value, but the decisions that we make on what we're going to continue to operate as we move forward. We're going to pay attention to that as well. For the existing buildings, we can't ignore it. We have almost 95 million square feet, 15,000 facilities. We actually measure, if you can believe this, electricity, heat, fuel, water, rubbish, recycled materials, and chilled water for all of those 15,000 facilities. Because our thought is if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And so we're very very on top of that. We've been doing that since 2002 and have a process in place where the people who are on the ground closest to the work input the data and take ownership of their numbers, and we find the behavior change by people being aware of what we're trying to get at has an enormous impact, and find that people who are closest to the work are really getting this and are driving the message up from the bottom, as well as the seniors who get it also driving it down from the top. So the top-down, bottoms-up approach is working very well for us. And, finally, we are looking for ways to not have a bit of our material go to landfill at the end of its economic life. And Bill's company has been very helpful to us, though he doesn't know it yet, helping manufacturers come up with products that are truly recyclable that we're going to embed in our design. And so that's an overview.
What I thought we'd do now is have a conversation among the people on the stage. Sorry? Oh, after.
It's all right. It's the woman thing.
The obvious blooper. Forgive me, Maria. Maria Atkinson is Global Head of Sustainability for Lend-Lease and is our next speaker. That's because I can't see you down here. I'm sorry.
Thanks, Bill. I'm actually representing the property industry. I'm not wearing white shoes, and clearly I'm the female as well. So Lend-Lease is a global property development, investment management, construction, and asset management organization. We're in 41 countries, and we have about 11,000 employees. So we're nearly 50 years old, and we've been into sustainability for that time. I think the points that have been made in this panel is really green building and accelerating it. So we want more clients that are informed, like Citigroup, because we've been challenged ourselves in managing our own carbon footprint in the buildings we occupy. But we need more governments, we need more clients, and we need more action. So I'm excited about getting into the panel discussion, because I think our job here is really to incentivize you, give you ideas about what works and what doesn't work. Lend-Lease will be the first organisation to do a carbon trade involving energy efficiency in buildings. And that carbon trade will be unique in that we'll demonstrate that the least cost carbon abatement, the thing we want to do in the next 10 years, is actually improve energy efficiency in buildings. And I'm not talking 10, 20, 30%. We've proven that deep cuts of 80% or more can be achieved. So in our global headquarters in Sydney, Australia, although we have about 80% of our revenue coming from offshore activities, we have about 2,000 employees in that building. And we know from employee data that 40% work for Lend-Lease because they like being in the building. So there's all sorts of ways of looking at the incentives and the benefit of green buildings. And I think through our conversation that we've had a chance to kind of have a run through at breakfast, you'll get some ideas that will stimulate some real action out of this.
Well, that was a big whoops on my part, so I'm sorry. Now, if I'm right, we're going to take a chance to have a dialogue among the people up here. And I thought we might stimulate that dialogue by asking a question that comes up quite often in terms of accelerating green buildings, is the role of certification and standards. And so I thought I'd open that up to the group in terms of how important has it been for you to see programs like BREEAM in the UK, like LEED in the United States, or the programs being developed in India, the programs being developed in China, and so on and so forth. Anybody want to take that one?
I'm going to start, just to reverse the last order. But I'm wearing the pin of the World Green Building Council, and many of you come from countries that are either have established green building councils, the successful model being the US, and Rick Fedrizzi, the CEO, is in the room with, thanks, Rick, to your effort. But of those 30 countries, many are trying to form green building councils. Now, a green building council's mission is actually to transform the property industry and to actually give a common language. And I think that's the point. We need to support green building councils for their education and their rating systems so we have a common language no matter where we are in the world of what is a green building.
I think what we have done in India is quite an extraordinary example. Everywhere else in the world, this green movement and Rick, you can correct me if I'm wrong, has been started by architects, designers, and individuals. But I think in India, the Confederation of Indian Industry took the lead. And with a captive sort of a group of 8,000 blue chip companies were able to move this much faster. I was at the Green Congress last week, and they said that they wanted to reach 1 billion square feet in the next 3 years. So that's quite a sort of a leapfrog. So I think that if countries are wanting to start the green business building movement, it would be a good idea to find stakeholders who can really accelerate the movement.
The other thing I think first of all, benchmarking is incredibly important, but I don't think you can take green building standards and use that as a substitute for thinking and analysis. And I think that's one of the fears, you know, that I have about green building standards, that I see people that will look at a LEED checkoff list and think they have a design for the building because they went down and picked off something out of every column to get enough points to be silver or whatever. And that does not constitute good design. That's as bad in the new direction as going in the wrong old direction is. So I think one of the things that I think it needs to be enforced as you develop standards, right, recognize that there are different asset categories and standards cannot be uniform across various asset categories. Second thing of, you should always think as a standard as a benchmark to start you to thinking about building performance and then a way to measure it against that once you get there, but not as a design guideline.
For Citi, being a large organization, 350,000 employees, 100 countries, it enables me to move a standard across the organization fairly quickly because of the training materials, for example, provided by the U.S. Green Building Councils that I would have to develop myself. And so we put this out there, and I'll give you an example of a couple of results. In Germany, we decided that we wanted to build a LEED building, and the design team got it early. And it looks like we'll wind up with a gold-certified data center, of all things, in Germany. I got a call from a project manager in Taiwan, and we're going to be a LEED tenant in the building, not owner. We have no right to change the design of that building. But the project manager said to me, you know, I think I can get the owner to build a LEED building. Can you tell us more about what that means? And we were able to, you know, draw on the standards. Is it perfect? No, and I think Rick would be the first to admit that. But it's a place to start, and we can get this movement going, reinforce it, educate. I'm a proponent of standards, actually.
Lately, the U.S. Green Building Council adopted a special innovation for new materials assessments based on cradle-to-cradle materials down to the assessments down to the parts per million, parts per billion, which we're very excited about. And we see that these standards can actually integrate some fine-tuning. On the other hand, I think that once you get past the generic checklist, clients are asking questions today that I think are taking us far beyond where a checklist would take us. And two examples on that. One, I'd like if Maria would address what she alluded to in terms of this carbon, the carbon credit question and for buildings. I think that's far more important than we realize, because one of the things when clients come and ask for a zero carbon building, which they are now coming and asking for, how do you do that? If you can do it on the building locally with photovoltaics and things like that, you discover that you may not be able to meet the needs of that building with locally produced energy. And so you start looking for offsets in one direction. Or another thing, we're working with some clients who are actually looking out and building windmills and paying for the windmills so they can put their name on the windmill and associate it with their project directly. So this carbon question gets really real when you try and become a positive actor in the carbon field. So, Maria, perhaps you could take up that carbon question.
Thanks, Bill. I think it's certainly pertinent. So if you want to build a home in the UK after 2016, that's in 9 years' time, that has to be a zero-carbon house. That exists. We've been in the large master plan communities. Lendlease was the developer of the Sydney Olympic Village, which was the largest solar-powered village back then in the year 2000. We also have the largest solar-powered community in Army Hawaii. But we have won the rights to develop the London Olympic Village, and we now have to go from what we were doing best in applying renewable innovation to figuring out how you actually get to zero carbon for a large development in London in less than 9 years. It's 2012, those Olympics. So what do we do as developers? We look at the solutions. So there's obviously energy efficiency, designing the buildings to be as efficient as they can be, looking at the application of alternative energy. Now, that's renewable energy, but also developers want to be the utility. We want to generate on-site energy and water solutions, and we can't do that without the partnership either with utilities or with the enablers, governments. So in London, we're desperately trying to find solutions to get to the zero carbon. We're also in the London environment with the EU carbon trading scheme. So that's led us to say, well, let's not go and buy credits from planting trees. Let's drive fiscal incentives for energy efficiency. Now, the UK government, with their leadership, are giving wonderful fiscal incentives, 100% R&D tax, all sorts of financial incentives to help the property industry get to the zero carbon. But what we are working on is the deep cuts. I'm talking about 60% or greater than the current emissions in buildings cost. And so if we decide that energy efficiency is the best option, we should give that high carbon value. I'm talking $20 a tonne and greater. High carbon value, and that changes the equation of what we can actually do to get to zero carbon.
I just want to take up the issue of standards. I think what LEED has done has set a basic minimum standard. So we've heard about replacing bulbs from CFL to from incandescent to CFL, but we are talking about in our buildings of having 100% daylight. We reached 88% of the building which does not require any artificial light during the day. And now we are getting clients, because we've introduced this baseline of LEED, to say that let's go beyond LEED. How can individuals in the organization make a difference? And that is the mission statement we carved out for the Standard Chartered Bank. For Shell in India, they said, people are getting ill in our buildings. What can you do about that? So I think LEED has sort of raised and established a benchmark, but this is the minimum benchmark, and that has provoked people to think beyond it.
It could belong to an owner's organization, to follow on with that, where we think that building information modeling, the design of buildings in 3D, you know, where a lot of the decisions are made up front, integrated, where you have the owner, the architect, and the builder at the table at the same time, is the wave of the future. And it will take some time to get there. But my thought is, why couldn't we build into that model green? Start from day one, with the products that are being developed, with the things that we're talking about in the room. Let's get in front of that wave, get it populated, and I think we'd put ourselves ahead of that curve and embed those standards.
You know, one thing about, just to reinforce something Maria said, you know, the economic value of carbon trading, right? A lot of our projects are projects I call have funny money. They have new market tax credits, historic preservation tax credits, things that imply a longer-term hold, someplace 7 years or out. So now, and then we have institutional investors that are partners on that. So if you think about that from a point of where we are now and where we believe we will be 7 years from now, if that carbon, you know, that reduced carbon footprint in buildings has value, in your exit strategy, when you're talking about how am I going to dispose of this asset, it ultimately has value. So today, even if it were only $3 or $4 a ton, someplace down the road, you know, with some government assistance in carbon trading, right, it might be $20 or $40 a ton. And for those people that are long-term holders in the asset management category, what that means is you need to be planning now for how you design this into your project because you're creating long-term value. So it's something I think all architects and owners really need to think about today and not when the final legislation or global courts are in place, because they will be there.
Great.
Well, I think our time has come to turn to the tables. There are going to be two questions that we would like you to address during your working session for the next 25 minutes, half an hour. Based on what you've heard and what you've been able to think about, we'd like you to address the two questions: why don't more people build green if it makes so much sense? And what are ideas for CGI commitments on green building that could be announced for next year? So I think consistent with the CGI, you know, what is commonsensical about this that we can approach and attack and bring forward into the world? And what great ideas can come out of this kind of work? So, David, I think that's it. Thank you, and we'll be back in 25 minutes.